How would your community survive a disaster? After the big storm, the fire, or the loss of your biggest employer, will people leave, fight, or come together? Our guest, Ricky Ott, has been there. In 1989, the Exxon Valdez oil spill hit her town of Cordova, Alaska. Her book, Not One Drop, is more than just a chronicle of the long struggle afterwards. Dr. Ott has lessons for any place under stress. Ricky Ott, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. I'm happy to be here.
For the first few that don't know you, can you briefly tell us why you were right there on the ground when the Exxon Valdez spill happened?
I can try. It's almost an unbelievable tale, but basically I had hopped around the country getting a master's and a doctorate quite randomly, but everything came up oil, and I decided to take one summer off, and that was in 1985 after I graduated with a doctorate in oil pollution and from the University of Washington in Seattle. And I thought, you know, I always wanted to go to Alaska, so I asked my friends to take care of my dog for the summer. I would be right back, and that was 24 years ago.
It's almost makes you believe in the invisible hand, doesn't it?
That's exactly what I felt on March 24th, 1989, when I was so traumatized after flying over Prince William Sound and seeing our fishing grounds just covered in oil. We flew into Valdez to refuel, and I remember just stepping out of the plane and staring at the mountains and thinking, my God, you know, what can I do? I know enough to make a difference. Do I care enough? That was the first challenge. And I realized academically I'd been prepared for this. It was like I was in the right place at the right time with the knowledge that everybody needed. Was I emotionally invested enough in the community? And I decided that I was. And I decided that also it was not going to be a this year kind of a thing, because I know what it's like trying to do social movements and trying to really fix something. It's going to take the rest of my life. So I just decided on the spot, I committed, and here we are talking about this over 20 years later.
And it still isn't over.
It is not over.
Wow. I want to try and focus, if we can, on the ways that communities can respond to this kind of disaster. And you've said the worst impacts were not just the destruction of the environment, as terrible as it was, and the loss of the fisheries with the jobs that that meant, but the impacts on the community itself. Can you tell us about that?
That was totally unexpected. It was something I had not been trained for. I mean, my training is in toxicology, it's in biology, the hard sciences. I had absolutely no forewarning or preparation for how much an oil spill would emotionally hurt me individually, my friends, the entire community. And it is an unforgettable experience when an entire community is traumatized at the same time. And I'm talking about the care providers, the children, you know, the police, the people who would normally help. The therapists and whatnot, everybody was knocked flat by this thing. And then you think you know how your community is going to respond, but when you talked about leave, fight, or come together, we did all of the above in sort of a progression. And by writing Not One Drop, what I hoped was to help, well, to understand what happened in my own community, and by so doing, be able to then help other communities prepare for disasters, because the sociologists are saying, get ready. We're going to see the 21st century is going to be full of man-made disasters because of this global climate crisis that we've got going on here. And for us, we tried to come together. But then Exxon, well, if you want to believe, for whatever reason, Exxon dumped a ton of money into the community. The initial contracts for fishermen to go out and work on the cleanup had clauses saying you will not talk to the press. And that money eventually split the community, as well as 4 years later, the delayed collapse of the fisheries of Prince William Sound. And suddenly we realized that this was not a 1989 thing alone. The killing kept going, and what were we going to do? How were we going to diversify our economy? And what did we want our future to look like? And there were lawsuits. We were polarized. We were fighting each other because everybody had sort of a, well, there was a big split. There was a just take any job that comes, let's just do it to get some money in town. And then there was another group that was saying, hold on, let's try to think this through, even though we have zero economy right now. It's kind of like we're starting over. What would we ideally want? And then let's try to build that. And ultimately, the lawsuits against clear-cut logging and coal mining and more oil and gas lease sales and a big industrial port and road were all successful or snarled things up enough where we could have these meetings and ask questions. What do we want our community to look like in 20 years? And people said, well, we want our commercial fisheries to come back, and we want to diversify our economy in ways that will grow that fishery back. So once we realized that was the vision, then other things fell away. Well, we couldn't really clear-cut log because that's not compatible with commercial fishing. It wrecks the fish habitat. So we started working together. We said, well, what action steps should we take? We came up with a prioritized list. And we actually managed to heal our community by working together for the common good. And now the sociologists say that that is exactly what you need to do. You need to switch people out of the victim mode into the survivor mode as fast as possible. I mean, we were 6 years spinning in circles before we came to grips with a collapsed economy and what were we going to do about it. We had been waiting for Exxon to give us money, the state to help us, the federal government, somebody, anybody to help us. And it all boiled down to, nope, we had to help ourselves. And I think that was one of the biggest lessons.
And tell me, how did this work in the sense that we generally picture, well, the mayor's going to call the town together, and that's usually a man, and then the authorities are going to come in from above, and it's all going to be worked out in a plan on some table, and that's the way it'll go. Talk to me about the real things that happen with community organizing, and especially, too, the role that women played.
Okay, let's do community organizing first. This was a real eye-opener for me. I had, up to this point, pretty much been an outspoken advocate of, you know, let's not do that, let's do this, but just saying it rather than seeing who would support me, right? So really, we were in a very extremely polarized situation. So what a handful of us did was we sat down and said, okay, if we're going to try to get this community to come together, what are the different cross-sections of our community? Who are the different business people? What are the different, you know, the main leaders? And I'm saying here not leader in the sense of the mayor, but leaders like if you invite so-and-so to come, he will tell a bunch of his friends, and a bunch of people will say, oh, if Gerald is going to go to the meeting, then I'm going to go too. So who were those people in our community? And we identified them, and like I couldn't talk to the mayor. We were polarized. But we decided that it was important for her, in this case, to come. So we identified friends of friends who could convince her that this was an important meeting to come to. And we did that for everybody on our list, six people, six key community people. And the requests were made, and we managed to get a letter in the paper, an invitational letter, a half-page ad signed by all these six community leaders, and people came to the meeting in droves. So it wasn't a group that did this. It was just simply saying a public meeting, you know, here's what's on the agenda. We got to try to figure out what to do because we're on the economic ropes, so to speak. Everybody recognized it's a crisis, so 60 people came, which, okay, that doesn't sound like much until you realize our town is 2,500 people. That counts, you know, children. So 60 people is a good number. And there were 20 volunteers out of that group that they would continue ad hoc meetings called when there was something too important to discuss. So because these were business people, they didn't want their time taken up for meetings that didn't need a decision made. And we had these meetings in a neutral place. That was really important. It seems crazy, but you couldn't pick a restaurant in town because sure enough, it turns out, you know, one flavor of political philosophy go, you know, Democrats go in our society, go to one restaurant and Republicans go to another. I didn't really realize that. So we picked the library meeting room as a neutral safe space to have these meetings. And we had the initial public meetings facilitated. And the other big learning for me was when you're dealing with a polarized situation and a cross-cultural situation, it's best to have a facilitator from the minority group or minority representation. In our case, First Nations people were in the minority. And when I finally woke up and started having First Nations people facilitate, the meetings really went a lot better. Then when we got into the library, when we reached that stage, we had like three or four meetings in public first before we started the library meetings. When we launched the library meetings, it was just us. And I remember desperately reading Collaboration, What Makes It Work, because I really didn't know. And one of the things was I had a lot of check marks from other communities that had been trying this. And again, this is like the mid-1990s. This is right when sustainable development, President Clinton had started the Sustainable Development, President's Council on Sustainable Development in the U.S. This is a whole new way of looking at things. So I read this article, Collaboration, What Makes It Work, and it said, ask people why they came to the meeting. And I thought that was the most silly thing because everybody had volunteered to come to this meeting, you know. But when I got to the meeting and there's 20 of us and it's just us and there's no facilitator and there were people that I had been suing, I didn't know what to do. So I just said, let's go around the circle and everybody share why you came to this meeting. And the first person was the former CEO of the bank, who is now the CEO of one of the Native corporations that was actually wanting to do clear-cut logging. And he said, blah, 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 and I'm tired of fighting. And we went around the circle, and everybody said their piece, and everybody ended with, and I'm tired of fighting. And that was our common ground at first, a commitment to work together because we were tired of fighting, and that was enough. It turns out that's really everything to get us to work together and design projects and, you know, start diversifying the economy. And it worked.
How did women fit into that overall picture?
Well, a lot of the guys in our community actively fish. And to do this full time, it required basically women. So I retired from fishing so I could do this full time. The ad hoc group, after 3 years of working together, decided to incorporate and form a nonprofit organization, which I was the founding director of for 1 year, and then I also passed it off to, there was a competitive search nationwide, but it ended up going to a locally based woman, and she's been running that now for 11 years. It was the first on the ground, hands-on, you know, applied sustainable community effort in all of Alaska, and it just got $1 million grant with Obama's stimulus package. So it's doing incredibly well. Huge community support throughout the watershed for this community-based, community voices, community action. That's what we call it, where people sit down together and say, this is a problem, let's address this. We go raise money for that issue. Everybody teams up, volunteers helping. You know, we bring in project coordinators and, you know, we have a to-do list and things get ticked off of it.
In your research, did you look at some of the developing world challenges like rebuilding after the Asian tsunami or things like that? Or are the tools there different from what we would use in North America?
Well, what we looked at was we asked, and here, actually, this was a key thing. One of the first questions we asked people was, what do you like about our community? And we give people 3 minutes to write the answer for that. And this exercise is actually called the Community Unity Exercise, and it's posted on my website, ultimatecivics.com. But you give people 3 minutes to answer questions. What do you like about living here? That shifts the mood from what was I fighting over to what is it that I like? What is it that we have in common? And you do this in small groups of 8 to 10 people. Make sure you get everybody's, you know, values. Check the ones where people have said the same thing. And you end up with a prioritized list of values. And then all the groups share. And pretty soon you realize that you all like living in the community for the same thing. So not all the values are about money. That was our big shock. they broke down into social values. For example, our community is safe for a place for raising children. We get to spend a lot of quality time with our kids, so we have safe neighborhoods. We have an opportunity to teach our children, to share our values with children. You know, put a dollar value on that. You really can't. They were environmental values, clean air, clean water. I mean, we need that for our salmon. We need that for ourselves. We can grow clean food here. Health care. We didn't really put a value on that. That's like we want to be healthy, so we want to have a lifestyle that supports good health. And then, of course, the economic things. Yes, people want a living wage and affordable housing and a job. So we realized we had social, economic, and environmental values. And what we decided was we wanted to bring in businesses, diversify our economy in ways that increased one form of value without one form of wealth without decreasing the other two. So we could measure things then, like clear-cut logging didn't work because it trashed environmental capital, and it really only raised economic capital, but if you look at it, it was mostly to out-of-town loggers, so that really didn't count either. But on the other hand, certified sustainable forestry, we could do. So ecotourism, we chose that over the big commercial industrial tourism, using our model of increasing all forms of capital. I mean, social capital is much stronger with growing your own businesses locally than having these big industrial cruise ships come in. So we actually came up with a definition of sustainable development that is now used in textbooks in the United States, because everybody was sort of grappling with, well, what exactly is sustainable development? Is it just a, you know, a new word that the old style logging companies can use to go push into new areas to log? And no, we came up with a definition and a way of making this work and living this and growing really a sustainable community, sustainable future.
Is there a movement or are there conferences held to develop these concepts of community survival responses?
There have been around oil spills, and I'm only aware of that because it's oil spills. Okay, so disaster preparation, disaster response. I am certainly available to come to communities, and it takes a full day, usually a Saturday, you know, to do a full community unity exercise to really do it right and take the time. But I have loaded the community unity exercise and some points on how to run a meeting up on the ultimatecivics.com website so that people can try this. But I will say, if your community is polarized and if people are fearful about a future, it really is helpful for whatever reason. This has got to be basic human nature, okay? To call somebody from outside in at first to help get you going, and then you can take over and do it yourself. That's what we did. If I had stood up initially and tried to run the meetings, we would have gotten absolutely nowhere because people in my own community had pigeonholed me on the environmental side of things, the fishing industry side of things. You know, you get pigeonholed when you're in these small communities in a little box. But now that we all have worked together, the opinions have shifted. But it's really critical when you're trying to start these things to get started on the right foot.
Did you ever get the Exxon Valdez compensation money? Did that come through?
Oh, well, ha-ha. We were supposedly compensated for our losses, a couple years back, but the court only identified short-term losses, not long-term losses. And so people basically... let me finish the story. And Exxon argued interest and just conceded this month. Okay, that's how current this is, in September, that yes, they need to pay interest. So now the interest payments are starting to come out. And both payments combined, punitive damages and compensatory, amount to about 7 to 10% of what people have totally lost from something that happened 20 years ago. It's just the whole system is broken. It's the legal system. It tilts to advantage the wealthy, guilty until proven wealthy. And the pathetic thing is that the legal system will treat every community in America just like it treated Cordova. So until we fix the problems here, and one problem is dysfunctional communities, But the second problem, I call this the democracy crisis. The second problem is these corporations wielding human rights. They never should have human rights. We need to, this is the corporate personhood problem.
Mm-hmm.
So they go hand in hand, and there's also information about the corporate personhood problem posted on ultimatecivics.com.
Okay, we'll check that out. We've been talking with Ricky Ott. She's the author of the definitive book on the Exxon Valdez spill. That's still a great read. It's called Sound Truth and Corporate Myths, The Legacy of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill. Ricky's new book is Not One Drop, Promises, Betrayal, and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill, published by Chelsea Green. You can find out another website at rickyott.com, spelled RIKIOTT.com. Ricky, thanks so much for your struggle to get something positive out of the disaster there.
Yeah, you're very welcome. And the difference between those two books is that Sound Truth is about the biology, the effects of oil on people and wildlife, and Not One Drop is about the sociology, the disaster trauma, what breaks, and how to heal a community.
Thank you so much. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.